Take a walk through Seoul's 500 years of ghastly murders, forbidden history, and hidden scandals. Listen to tales of Korea's deepest, darkest secrets. What lies under the concrete? Or who? The Dark Side of Seoul Ghost Walk at darksideofseoul.com. Book now, if you dare.
And welcome to the Dark Side of Seoul podcast. This is Joe.
This is Sean.
Today we're going to talk about modernizing traditions. Okay, that sounds like a very dry topic, but seriously, this is really cool.
Yeah.
And Sean has had a good bit of experience with this recently. I would say, because, you know, Sean is the folklore expert of our team. I'm the dad joke expert.
There's two of us.
Yeah. That's really good stories. We're going to talk a little bit about a really good story of what's happened on our tour, what our tour company's done, which I'm very personally so proud of. I get actually misty eyed thinking about it. I'm very proud of it. So, Sean, what do we have in store today?
Yeah. So this is a big thing about a lot of my research as well, is about how rituals, folk traditions and whatnot, they change all the time. And that's what we're going to talk about, how a lot of Korean traditions and whatnot that are linked to ghosts and spirits and rituals, rites that are connected to those themes are changing. It's causing a bit of, I think, kind of cultural, social turmoil and debate, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. I'll get into why I think that's interesting and unnecessary in a little bit as we go through. But before we start, I think I'm going to highlight the difference between rite, R-I-T-E, and ritual. So, because I think they're kind of used interchangeably, but a key difference to remember between them is that the rite or a rite is the act. The act of something. Mm-hmm. And the rituals are the actions, the things that you do during the rite. So the rite could be, for example, preparing an offering for the dead, for the spirits. But then the way you give the offering of incense, the food, the way you turn a cup of booze around the incense smoke, those are the rituals. Those are the rites, the actions that you do within the rite. I think that's a very good way to remember a key difference between the two of them. They are linked. People do use them as synonyms, but there is a bit of a difference between the two. I think it's important. So, but traditions change. Is the key thing. They change. It isn't inherently bad. I've mentioned this in episodes before. It isn't inherently bad that things change. There's far more dead heritage in human history than there is living heritage today. Far more. We've lost far more traditions, or we've given up and we've disregarded far more traditions than what's currently being practiced, without doubt. Our sensibilities shift, our beliefs change over time, our environments change, or the environments alter, and the environment often dictates what ritual is and what ritual becomes, and rites and things like that, what they become. Our lifestyles require different things from us, and therefore we view the rites or the rituals within the rites differently, and then they change like that. So life changes generally. And if traditions don't change, then they don't update. And we get stuck. We get stuck in patterns. And then our culture just becomes stagnant. It's very, very boring. It's like language, where language is live, language is changing. Right. So is folklore. And folklore has legs. Folklore travels around the world. Traditions, that's why there are similarities among different rites and beliefs and whatnot through cultures around the world. So they can but they can persist today. I think this is a key thing to remember. Rights can continue. They can persist in a modern form. And that's why currently in Korea is such an exciting time, because so many things in terms of tradition are really changing, observably changing. We can see the changes happening in real time.
Yeah. In just the 20 years I've been here, I've really witnessed a lot of changes just in culture and traditions.
Easily. It's so observable. It's interesting. Now, I think some of the changes are coming from a place where there's no foundation of interest. And unfortunately, so people are throwing traditions away. That's unfortunate, because I think these things can still continue in some form, but simplified and modernized. So, and I'll get a little bit more into that. But because we don't have to believe everything that our ancestors believed in. We don't have to do what they did. And obviously, we don't believe and don't do what they did. But we don't have to throw all this away either. Right. I think that's a key thing. So, there is a problem with traditionalists as well. People push back against traditionalists, especially, and I think there are two reasons for it. There are two things that traditionalists do that make other people generally dislike them. Mm-hmm. And the first thing is that traditionalists have too much influence. They have too much power on society, on what people can and cannot do, what you're supposed to say, how you're supposed to perform things. Traditionalists will have way too much power. And in Korea, of course, it's in most places, it's the older generation that try to dictate how things should be done. And also it can be the government as well, and other authorities and whatnot. They can have too much influence, and then they just become annoying. And people will eventually start to have some sort of animosity towards authority. And I think that's what happens. If traditionalists try to maintain a position of authority, people are going to push back. They're just not going to like what they're doing.
Right.
The second thing they do is that they insist things should never change. Or change as little as possible. So then that makes people upset. They're like, okay, well, we're stagnant. Well, I'm not interested in this at all now, because I'm supposed to do it this way. But you're saying I can't even do it slightly differently. Then people will just, then instead of the traditionalists allowing for the slight change, the other people, the modernists or revisionists, will just disregard the entire thing.
Reject it because they're being too parochial.
Right, right. So then throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak.
Yeah.
Those are just some of the key things, I think, to keep in mind as we go into the topic. So the main traditions that are still being done by most people in Korea today are the chaesa and the chade, the mm-hmm. the rites for ancestral spirits.
They so chade is the tables with food on them.
That's essentially it. Those are the offerings and other things as well, incense, you have different setups and things like that.
Right.
So a key thing though is that chaesa, the ancestral, and chade, which is the general term for it, and then chaesa is what it's called when it happens at different holidays and whatnot, or chade is when it's during different holidays. They're regional and they're familial as well. They're different by region. They're different by family.
Right.
And this has always been the case. It has not, chaesa has not been practiced in a uniform way ever across Korea.
Right. I mean, Thanksgiving, Christmas, those are family holidays, and everyone does it different. Different regions do it differently.
That's right, and there are some key things that make it what it is. So, everyone generally, if they celebrate Christmas, they'll have a Christmas tree in some form or another. Mm-hmm. but the way they do it, the way they decorate it, how they decorate it,
and
the
when ritual, they decorate it.
And when they decorate it, the ritual of it,
right,
it is different by family and by region. So, for example, I grew up where we would follow the older tradition. We would put up our tree closer to Christmas Eve because that was generally the way it was done. And the idea was that in the past, you go to church on Christmas Eve, you come home, then you decorate your tree. Mm-hmm. So, and then your tree stays up until January 6th, old Christmas Day. So then that gives you the 12 days of Christmas. Mm-hmm. So, so that's what we did generally. And then we would have a big meal on old Christmas Day on January 6th. Then that the holiday is done. Christmas is finished. But I know tons of people who didn't do that, in Newfoundland.
Yeah. Very different. My family. Yeah.
Right.
We get it as early as possible because we love the smell of the tree. And there's so many things going on in our lives that we want to just, I mean, Christmas Eve's packed enough anyway. We want to throw putting up ornaments on top of that. And it's hard enough getting the kids to go to sleep.
Right.
So, you want to get that done at some point because it's the anticipation is just too hard. Yeah.
Right. And still for me, we put up our tree quite late, usually on the weekend before Christmas. Or if Christmas falls, say, on a Thursday or a Friday, we'll put the tree up on like Wednesday or something like that. Mm. And the reason I still prefer to do that is that to me, when these traditions are shortened, when they happen in a shorter frame of time, to me, it gives them more importance. Mm. They're rarer. And then rarity to me equates value. So, and I feel that way about traditions and celebrations and whatnot as well. And so we still do that because that's what I grew up with. I see value in it. And so so this is our familial heritage of how we celebrate Christmas. And I'm passing it on to my daughter. And it's very likely if she later has kids, she'll probably practice and celebrate Christmas in the same way, if at all, if she chooses to. And I'm sure she will because Christmas is fun.
So, it is fun. It's a fun holiday.
Right. So, so there's always differences. So sometimes the media, though, the Korean media and even books and scholars, scholars, God. The only thing I dislike more than scholars are aristocrats. And aristocratic scholars, rather get a Christmas tree to the balls and listen to most of these people. But authorities.
Yeah. I'm digressing. You remind me of that. Okay. You went and saw my play Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
There's a line I like when Puck and Oberon, Puck is telling Oberon about that, the actor, the putting on a play, and Puck says something about actors and Oberon goes, ew.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 The way he delivers the guy playing Oberon, the way he delivers it too is great. It's very funny.
I'm sorry, that was hilarious. Because you're talking about us and we're kind of like, ew, we don't like scholars. Yeah. The way he was talking about, ew, don't like actors.
Yeah. That's great. Despite what people like this say and authorities and whatnot, there have always been regional and familial differences. I mean, it's almost certain, it's guaranteed, even though it's not been recorded. And I didn't record how I celebrate Christmas, right? So definitely different. But then this creates the debate, the arguments and the debates that are, these days are especially online, and how to follow these things, how to celebrate them and whatnot. But none of this is concrete. Lore, tradition, it's not concrete. Nothing is incorrect. So debating is completely pointless. What should be done, and this is the folklore approach to it, is that you record all of it with no bias, and then you have a product, you have a record of how very similar traditions were celebrated in slightly different ways. And then you have a vaster understanding of what tradition means to that group of people, instead of this monolith of culture, which doesn't exist. It's complete nonsense.
Right. So you have the gatekeepers for something that doesn't even exist.
We'll return to the podcast after this message.
In our first comic, We explored ghastly Korean folktales while walking the streets of Seoul. This time, we are ambling the Korean highlands with terror tales set in those storied landscapes. Welcome to the dark side of Seoul, weird tales from Korean lore, mountains of the macabre.
Right, right. So it's very silly. So just very quick, an example of how things are changing today. My in-laws, and I think I mentioned this in an episode some time ago where my mother-in-law, when my brother-in-law passed away last year, this recent, he passed away before Chuseok and then obviously then before Seolah, the new year, it was Lunar New Year. So both times she set up at our table or just the supper table where we're eating, she set up an empty space with a bowl of rice, an apple, a pear, a Chinese pear, with the tops cut off. She followed that tradition, which is done because the idea, as it's explained, is that the spirits can access the fruit more easily when you cut the tops off. Mm-hmm. And then some chungju, some booze that she picked up. She did get chungju, the clear alcohol.
I like chungju.
Yeah, and then had the chopsticks and the spoon and some jeon, some of the pancakes and stuff, and all of it was set out for him. And then that was there at an empty empty spot at the table. So, which is very similar to how a lot of people in the West, they'll set up like a Christmas dinner. They'll set up the space for like their father who passed away just before Christmas or something like that.
Right.
So you see these kinds of things around the world. And that's how some Koreans today are simplifying chaesa, the honoring of the dead. So and it's happening in my in-law's house. So now, just quick then on the table setting. The table generally is set following tradition, but it would have changed, and it has changed. I'll get more into that. So generally what you do with the chaesa table is that it faces north. So when the living is sitting on one side, we are on the south side of the table looking north. And then the idea is that on the opposite side, the ancestral spirits descend and that's where they sit. So then you set up all the food in such a way that the main course, like the rice and a soup, is at the north end of the table because that's the main meal. And then you have maybe other things like other soups. Then you have a jeon. And then the very last thing that's on the south side of the table closest to the living are the fruit, the sweet things, because that's dessert. So the ancestral spirits are eating from the north end of the table to the south side of the table. So that's generally how it's said to be done. So, and a lot of people will still follow that. There are differences, though. There's also a tradition that's called Hongdong Paekso. So that's literally it means red east, white west. So Hong, red, Dong, east, mm-hmm. Paek, white, so, west. So this means that you put anything that's red, especially fruit, on the east side of the table, and anything white or a lighter color, like pears, which are more of a yellowish, you put them on the west side of the table. And so that is still being done by a lot of people today. But there's a key thing about this that I'll get to in a few minutes as well. Some of the things that are changing, many people don't face the table north. They don't bother. They don't bother anymore. They don't care. They don't think that's especially important. So if they do have a chaesa in their home, they won't have the table facing north. They just won't bother with it. In my mother-in-law's place, when she sets up the table for my brother-in-law, the space is where he always sat when we'd meet at their house for the different holidays or whatever, wherever he sat at the table when we would eat, that's the space that she prepares for him. It doesn't face north. And actually, thinking of it, it faces east. So, yeah. So this is showing that this particular concept is not really important to a lot of people anymore. There's also a debate about just the putting the food, the like I just said, the Hongdong Paekso, red east, white west. There's a debate about that as well. Should they go to one side or the other? Should they not? There's also a debate that I've come across in research. Are apples red or are they white? Because when you cut the top off an apple so the spirits can access the fruit, it's white. So where do you put it? You put it on the east or you put it on the west? Some people say it's predominantly red, so it goes to the east. Other people have said that I've come across in research is that it's both, therefore put it in the middle.
This sounds like the ingredients for a Monty Python sketch.
It sounds like an ingredients for a family arguing, which is a big thing at these holidays as well, especially in modern times. So, but that's why you always have some sort of authority, like the oldest male or something, that they make all these decisions. But there could be discussion and debate. So this one family that I did research, they couldn't decide if apples were red or white. So their compromise was put it in the middle. So of the table. There you go. The order is not always followed, or it's different. Like I was saying, like the putting the rice at the north, the top of the table, the traditionally the north end, and then the fruit in front and things like that. All of that gets shifted and changed. It doesn't necessarily have to be followed. So another interesting thing is that none of this actually appears in any old texts about ancestral rites. Uh-huh. All the oldest texts that were introducing this type of thing to Korea apparently don't make any reference to the Hongdong Paekso. It came later. It came much, much later. So that doesn't mean it's not a tradition. It just means it didn't come here initially. It just developed over time. And then some people do view it as a tradition. And if a family does it and they think it's important, it's a familial tradition. So there should be no argument about whether you should or should not do it. If your family does it and believes that it is correct, then it is correct. If the family doesn't do it, if they're not necessarily concerned about the order, then that's also correct. It's all about the family tradition. So that's something that's really key to all this as well. Another really interesting thing is that at least in more modern traditions, and probably for quite a long time, kimchi was never offered on the chaesa table.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just think, if you look at photos of an old chaesa table, you very likely will not see kimchi on it. Kimchi is not an offering to the dead because spirits dislike it.
Oh.
So you don't put generally fermented food. You'll never put a fermented fish. The only thing would be fermented would be like a soybean soup, and it's not really fermented, I suppose, but
it's diluted.
Diluted, yeah. So, if you put a fish or something, it would be a dried fish. It wouldn't be, or it'd be cooked, but you could put like a myungtae, or the pollock, something like that on the table, but it'd be dry. Or it'd be cooked, it'd be steamed or grilled, and you put that down as well. But it wouldn't be anything that you wouldn't put things that are spicy. That's what people said. The dead don't like spicy things. So generally you wouldn't see kimchi on an old table of chaesa. But again, that would have shifted depending on family. But it is becoming more common these days. More and more people are starting to put kimchi on the table. And this creates a debate, more debate. Is kimchi red or is it white? So what would you say, Joe, if you were in this debate and someone said, Joe, you're the food expert, what would you say?
look at the freaking kimchi. Is it red or white? Just look at it.
Well, I mean, like, it's kind of like the apple thing, right? It's both.
Right? It's well, we'll just put it a little bit, you know, it's like one of those graphs, you know, you just put a little closer to this, you know, a little closer to the center, just in case, you know.
Right. Put it in the middle next to the apples.
It is like, is it mostly red?
Right. Right.
Mostly,
there you go.
Like mostly dead, you know, it's mostly red.
So, and then for some people, this may create debate as well. So, unnecessary debate, as I've already stated, but it does create debate. And then another thing that's starting to grow, linking, going back to kimchi as being something that isn't really traditional as an offering on chaser tables and chade tables, more and more food items that really were never put down on the table. Dakboki is an example. So duck, rice cake, they would have been put down. Rice cake would have been put as an offering. But the dakboki, the actual dish, the spicy rice, I was going to call them tubes, not tubes, cylinders, I guess is what you call them. People will put things like this on the table now. Ramyun, even cup ramyun, will become more and more common, has become more and more common to put on offerings, as offerings on these tables. And then there's even more debate. Is dakboki red or is it white? The sauce is red, but the duck is white.
Again, so, center.
Yeah. So people will just either not care or they'll just put it in the center. Yeah. Or it just won't be an offering at all. And so, and again, a lot of people don't care because the concept, and a lot of people argue, is that, oh, it didn't come, it wasn't this way way, way back. This wasn't part of the older tradition when it was introduced to Korea from China. So, you know, don't have to follow it. And then more modern foods as well, talking about cup ramyun. Ramyun, of course, isn't modern, but cup ramyun is modern. Instant ramyun, that's all modern. And you will find other things on offering tables. Hamburgers, cheeseburgers, chicken burgers, pizza, chocolate, beer, instead of Chungju, instead of the clear alcohol, or along with the Chungju, they'll also put a can of beer. Mm-hmm. And they'll open, and of course it will be opened. Generally, also what a lot of people in the West would do if they have a can of beer, like when my father passed away after the funeral, in the cremation, we had his ashes in his urn. It was at my mom's place. And we opened a can of beer and we put it next to his urn. So after about 2 hours, my brother said, "Dad, you're not done with that yet?" And then my brother drank it. bananas are common as well to see now in on tables. So generally what the concept for a lot of people is today is that you give food, whichever ancestor you're calling to the table, you offer them things that you know that they liked in life. And today in Korea, Koreans have access to way more types of food. So in the past, where it was just predominantly rice cakes, jeon, which also a lot of people say you don't have to give as offerings, there's more access now to food. So you give more offerings, more types of food. People are eating more things now. So add it to the tradition. That's how tradition changes. It changes with time. And there is no traditionalist that can convince me otherwise. You're inherently wrong to say that you can't do it. I've never heard a decent argument from anyone to suggest that these types of things are wrong. So anyone can try. If you want to try to change my mind, send us a message or an email. I challenge you to try to change my mind, and happy to have a fun debate, friendly debate about this kind of thing if you're interested. So then this, of course, then creates, speaking of debate, all this kind of, the idea of putting these types of foods on the table creates this debate. Traditionalists will really fucking lose their minds about this kind of thing. You'll see them young and old, not just older generations. You'll see younger people as well saying, you can't put a pizza on the chaser table. You can't put a slice of pizza there. Well, why not? Sure you can. Why can't you? What is the point?
Well, it's not Korean, they'll say. But a lot of foods are not Korean originally.
Well, neither. Well, chaser isn't Korean. Yeah. So apples were introduced to Korea. Yeah. And apples were not part of now they're considered a distinctly important offering to the dead, apples. Right. They didn't become part of chaser until the 20th century.
Right.
They didn't come to Korea until like the 1880s, 1890s. And it was mostly foreigners that were eating them. And then they didn't really catch on in Korea until sometime later. And then very likely not used as an idea, as a main offering that became so important that it just ingrained itself into the chaser rituals that it's less than 100 years old. So that's not Korean either. So none of the argument, again, I challenge anyone to if you want to debate it. There's so many things that just aren't Korean that are part of chaser. And like I said, and these rituals themselves, they've been in Korea a very, very long time. They're Koreanized versions of Chinese tradition. It doesn't mean that they're not important or that they're less valuable in Korea. They're extremely important. But my point is, the argument that these things like pizza isn't Korean, it doesn't hold water, because then you have to then acknowledge that chaser was also introduced to Korea just like pizza was.
Mm.
So, these types of debates are quite interesting, but ultimately silly. Yeah, So then, to the thing now, what Joe was saying at the beginning about what we did recently, which kind of inspired this episode, the difference in or the updates and the changes to these rituals and whatnot linked to ghosts and spirits and offerings to the dead. We recently, I won't say his name, just to maintain his privacy, because he had a very personal request from our tour company. So there was a man from Canada who sent us an email, I guess it was, because you, Joe, you'll know, because I didn't, you told me. So how did he get in touch with us?
Email.
It was okay. So he sent us an email. Okay. So right. I saw the email, but not in the email. We put it in on our Trello board where I saw it. And so he sent us an email and he told us a story about how his father, and I got more information when I met him, his father fought in the Korean War with the Canadian Army and was here pretty much the whole time and suffered a lot of trauma, a lot of terrible experiences. He saw people trying to collect scrap metal, going into areas where they knew there were mines, and they were hoping to collect bits of blown up mines and whatnot, just to collect scrap. And he saw on several occasions, including children stepping on mines and losing a leg or even worse. Mm-hmm. So the man left Korea. He was just 22, 23 at the time when the war, I think when the war was done, when he was discharged, went back to Canada, got married. About 3 or 4 years later, started a family and lived with this trauma, these terrible memories for his whole life. And then he never spoke about them either. Everyone knew he fought in the Korean War. His family knew, but he just wouldn't talk about it. Then the man who was on the tour, I'm going to call him Mac just to give him a name.
Okay.
So Mac then said that a couple of years before his father died, he finally opened up about what he had experienced in the war. And then he said how he had been carrying the memories of these people with him for 50 years. And then Mac's father died. Now, this was 20 years ago that his father died. And then Mac felt like he inherited his father's trauma and the memories of the Korean people who his father saw killed in the war. Not soldiers. You know, soldiers die in war. That's their job. It's awful, of course, but it happens. But seeing these innocent people, especially kids, just trying to survive war.
Yeah.
And so Mac felt he inherited all this. And he was thinking for two decades on how to help his father's spirit, I guess we could say,
right,
to get rid of these memories and how to calm the memories themselves, to release them and to kind of do something for the memory of the people that the nameless people that his father saw killed. And it took him 20 years to figure it out. He had no idea how to approach it. And then just by chance one day, he found us online, then looked into us, listened to the podcast, and then found out that we, you know, the core of what we do is tourism. And he got in touch and sent Joe an email, shared that story, and then made a request for to have a tour with our fellow guide who works with us, Simon, who works in our Korean War centered tours.
And he was working. He worked with us on Anthony Bourdain. He was one of the right interpreters, and you'll see him in the show every now and then in that episode.
Right. Yeah. Right. And then his family also had some very interesting things happened during the Korean War.
Yes. Simon does a separate Korean War tour where it's really about his grandfather's story, which is captivating.
Yeah, should be a film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So and then Mac also requested a tour with me. And so we took some time, several days, to kind of break down, think what we could do. And so on my end, I offered Mac a simplified chesa for his really for the memories of the people that his father saw killed in the war, and very unorthodox to do a chesa like that. Extremely unorthodox. I spoke with a lot of people, Koreans, about this to get their opinions about it and whatnot. My wife and colleagues, and they all agreed it was actually, and shamans, mudang, spoke with people like that.
Right.
And there was, I had no pushback. Everyone said, yes, that's a really good idea. And they all agreed that it was unorthodox, a little bit strange, but okay, fine to do. It was okay to do it. So my wife and I designed the chesa table. Predominantly she did. And then when I met with Mac, we have a little foldable, another example of things changing in Korea. We have a small foldable chesa table that people can bring to like grave sites and things like that. And so we got everything. We made the offerings very simple. We got an apple, a pear, some yakgwa, some snacks, and some very good incense, some chungju, the alcohol, the clear alcohol, and some other things, dates as well, dried dates, and set it up in a mountain facing north in Paju, which Mac thinks is where his father fought. He was stationed in the Paju area, where a lot of Canadians were stationed. And that is also where in Gapyeong, in the north, that's where one of the Canadian war memorials is. And then we had a very, very simplified chesa. done outdoors, which is common. It's been common for a long time to do a simple chase outdoors. Like I said, they'll do them at grave sites, things like that. And the very interesting thing was when we started the chaser, Mac went first to do the bow. He was kneeling down in front of the table. I poured the Chungju into the cup. Then you turn it three times around the incense smoke before you give it as an offering. As soon as we started, cherry blossoms, the remaining cherry blossoms that were on the trees around us were plucked off of the trees, and we experienced what the Koreans call kot bi. So kot is flower, bi is rain. So it's literally flower rain, petal rain. So a light breeze plucked all hundreds of these remaining cherry blossom petals off of the trees. The petals, fluttered and through the area where we were holding the chesa on top of the mountain. And then when all this was happening, I looked up, there were butterflies everywhere.
Wow.
Very, very interesting. Remarkable timing. Or is it something bigger than timing? And I'll just point out, this was just recently, but cherry blossoms in this area, especially in the north, in Paju area, especially in the higher mountains, do stay out much longer than they do in Seoul. So it was the last bits of flower on the trees and the butterflies. It was amazing. It was really interesting. And and then at the end, Mac noticed, he said he saw it. He not noticed all like in his peripheral vision, and then was kind of shocked. He was, oh my God. He's like, that was really cool. It didn't distract him from the bowing and the offerings, but he was really taken aback by that. So it was a really cool thing that happened while we were performing this very simplified chesa. And then we sat down, we drank some of the booze, we ate some of the food, and then we packed up, and then we walked down, then we came back down the mountain. And then the next thing that I arranged for Mac was a shamanic ritual. We went and saw Mudang, and I arranged her.
Okay, come on. Can we plug who it was?
Oh, well, it was Jane, yes. So we have an episode with Jane. yes, right.
Can we please, right. I mean, to support our
yeah, yeah.
guests.
Our friend Jane, guests. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So if anyone listened to our episode, interview with the shaman, I think that's what it's called, something like that.
Interview with the shaman, yeah.
That's like in our first...
Or interview with the Mudang, or interview with the shaman, yeah, something like that. Yeah.
That's in our first or second year of the podcast. It's been a while ago. It was a while ago, I should say. But anyway, so you can go back and listen to that episode to get Jane's story. So I spoke with Jane to see if she'd be willing to do something for Mac. And she said, yes, just give me some information, what he's doing it for, what he needs, what's his purpose. And I gave it to her and she said, okay. And it's all set. And we set up the day. It was just Sunday past, and we went to her house, and she had the shrine all set up. The table was all set, and a very interesting thing was that on the table she had donuts, which of course is not traditional Korean stuff. Even like the Korean donuts, like kwabegi, the traditional ones aren't really put on tables traditionally. Some people definitely would. And just a sidebar on that, my wife has said when her mother passes away, we have to put kwabegi, those twist donuts, on her chesa table because she loves them. She absolutely adores those. So, but she went to Krispy Kreme and she had three donuts on a plate. And Jane said that when she was preparing for the rite, she was communing with spirits, and Mac was really shocked by that, because it turned out that his aunt and his uncle, who is he was really close with, who passed away some time ago, a long time ago, they were donut bakers. And she said spirits were telling her to give donuts as offerings.
Hmm.
So
spirits love donuts, man. You heard it here first, man.
Yeah. And so so then the idea would be that that Jane maintains and is that she was communing with the spirits of Mac's aunt and uncle. And then they were there. They were feasting at the table as well. And they wanted donuts. And they said donuts as a sign to Mac, so they would know, or he would know, that it was them. So that was a really interesting thing. Mac didn't tell me that beforehand. I had no idea. He only really told me about his old man, and not really deeply. Not until we had already met. He told me we had some chicken and beer. And he was then opening up a little bit about his father and whatnot. But yeah, so donuts, a very, very unusual offering traditionally, but not unusual today. It can definitely be put on a table. And in this shaman rite, this Mudang rite, they were there because, as Jane said, spirits told her to put them there. And it would line up with the idea that it was actually spirits from Mac's family. So interesting. And then that's pretty much it. We did other things. Jane also prepared three talismans, and we have a whole episode about Bujok, also from a couple of years ago now. And he was given one to burn on the day. He was given one to burn on the anniversary of his father's death, the next anniversary coming up. And then the third one was folded, put into a really tiny envelope, and then Mac is meant to keep it on him, like in his wallet. And he can burn it later in the future. If he feels like he wants to get rid of it, he can burn it. And so those are that's more traditional, though. But there was a blending of this modern and traditional at the rite with Jane, the Mudang, the shaman rite. And just one last thing, there is, I'm not even sure if I've spoken about this company before, this organization called the Sungyunguan, which is linked to the university, the Sungyunguan University, which is old, and 1398, I think they were established in the early years of Chosun. A Confucian school, and still now Confucian University. They focus on engineering also, I think. I think they're well known for their engineering college. But they have an organization called the Ritual Establishment Committee. And they try to be an authority on rites for the public. Like, they kind of try to tell the public how to do rituals and rites. I think they're a bit archaic. Ultimately, I think I like what they do, but I think their focus should be more on encouraging people to follow Chesa, perform Chesa and Chade based on family tradition and what they feel is okay to do. They're still trying to be this authority that says it doesn't have to be as vast and complicated as it was in the past, in the not so distant past. You can simplify it. They're like, instead of having a whole table of food, just have 9 dishes of food, 9 different types of food. It's like, no, why don't you just have 2? You don't have to have 9. I think their focus should be on the intent rather than the intent of the rite rather than the rituals of the rite. I think that's extremely important. That's how you get people to continually enjoy and acknowledge and and respect their own culture and traditions, like Chesa. Another thing that I don't like about them is that, and this is a quote about them, they support the enhancing of Confucianism for the sake of all the people and the nation. It's a very archaic sounding Pak Jung-hee era type of language that I think just doesn't appeal to a lot of people today. I don't think that's going to do a good job of influencing people to maintain these traditions. But overall, I do like what they're doing. I do like that they support the idea of simplifying and modernizing rites and the rituals within the rites. And they recognize that a lot of them are outdated, but I think their language should be a little bit more simple, I guess, and more simplistic and acknowledge how things can change within families. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's just a little bit about how ghosts in Korea today love pizza.
Ghosts love pizza.
Dude, if I go first and you're involved in anything for a Chesa for me, don't forget pizza.
Yeah, but you gotta be picking, like, where the pizza's coming from, and I gotta get you the whiskey that you want.
Well, it's all fine. I don't think I'd really mind too much.
Yeah, I think you would mind if I gave you a pizza maru with bugogama.
yeah, I wouldn't like that.
Yeah,
not a Korean pizza, please.
No, I'll get you something from Spell Out or from Aqueduct or something like
that. Yeah, sounds good. Yeah.
Well, Hokey Pokey's pretty good. I had that last week or so. It's pretty good.
Sounds good.
All right. So, do we have any media recommendations or anything?
Yeah, just a few movies. I mean, because the idea of rites and rituals are really a big component of a lot of horror films. The three that popped in my head when I was thinking about movies linked to rituals. Of course, you can say The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby and stuff like that. But those are a little bit too obvious. So one of them is A Dark Song, which I think I've recommended on another episode. I don't remember which one, but A Dark Song, fantastic film from several years ago. Mm-hmm. The Devil Rides Out, a great Hammer film from the late 60s. Love that film. And Necromancy, a film from the early 70s. Really, really good.
Not Necromancer.
No, Necromancy. Yeah, so A Dark Song, The Devil Rides Out, and Necromancy.
And three, not Necronancy.
No, not necromantic. People who know that movie.
Necromantic.
Yeah, people who know that movie know that that's not the movie I'm talking about. if you don't know that movie, check it out. But be viewer beware. That's all I'm going to say. No spoilers or trigger warnings, none of that horse shit. Okay. Just viewer discretion advised.
I followed your directions and I've not looked at the listener mail.
Okay. Yeah, we got a really nice long message from I'm not sure if it's Gisela or Gisela Nunez. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. She sent us a message on Instagram, quite long, and I'm condensing it here, just kind of get the key points. And she said, "I'm a big fan of the podcast. It merges most of my interests together: folklore, history, food, horror media, and everything else macabre. I'm really thankful for your work, as it has helped me really dive deeply into some of those interests. I've been dreaming about visiting South Korea for years, and once I finally get the chance, I'll definitely join you guys on the tours." Thank you so much, Sean and Joe, for making my days more joyful and helping me learn so much these past few months.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Gisela.
Thank you for that. And
wow. Again, I'm really, it's weird because, I crave compliments, but I don't know what to do when I get them. So it's like, oh, imposter syndrome is attacking me right now. Yay. Thank you so much. Oh,
yes. Looking forward to seeing you when you come to Korea.
Looking forward to that. I mean, stay in touch with us. Keep writing us. Open the lines. I'm at Zen Kimchi on Instagram. Sean controls our dark side Instagram. Did Gel do it through Instagram or through Facebook?
Yeah, it was Instagram. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm Zen Kimchi. So That's where I am. You just see pictures of food.
It's funny because for Facebook, most of our messages are about the tours. People ask like, oh, where is it ends and how long is it and stuff like that. We get info about the tours, questions about the tours. And then on Instagram, most of our messages are directly like compliments or requests or now and again, we'll get a little bit of bitching and moaning, but usually not. And so there you go.
Well, you get more of those types of communications. I mean, I'm seeing more of the Facebook account. I'm not really seeing the Instagram account except as a third person.
Right. So, but anyway, thank you again, Gisella. I'm sorry. I think it's Gisella. That's what I'm going to say. Gisella.
I'm dying on that hill.
Yeah.
Yep.
So thank you so much for your message.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So, everyone, just remind you that we do have our comic books, Weird Tales from Korean Lore. You can get over at Dyson Comics Cafe near Jeonghan Kimpyeong Station in Seoul, or you can just order them online at darksideofseoul.com. The Dark Side of Seoul podcast is produced by Joe McPherson and Sean Morrissey. Our opening and closing music is by Sonic. That's a line from the play. Our opening and closing music is by Sonic-san. She find on Bandcamp under Jeju Digital. We'd like to thank our top-tier patrons, Angel Earl, Joel Bonamini, Sharon Cullen, Devin Hifner, Gabby Palomino, Steve Marsh, Mitchie Brewer, Ron Chang, Mackenzie Moore, Hunter Winter, who just friended me on Facebook, Cecilia Lufgren-Dumas, Emily Umbau, Josephine Riedberg. I want to say Josephine, is it? Don't you think it's Josephine? All this time I've been saying it wrong. Anyway, David Weatherly, Janice Song, or Yannis Song, I will say. Devin Buchanan, Edward Bradford, and Eva Sikora. Thank you so much for being part of our group. You can join this group over at Patreon. Sorry, patreon.com/darksideofseoul. Starting at just $5 a month, you can get a lot of extra content. If you go up to the $20 level, you join this group. We get a private chat room and all this extra stuff, really. We actually mail stuff to you. All right. Thank you for listening. Until next time, stay spooky.
Good night.